while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives. Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York.
WBAI New York. It's 7 o'clock in beautiful downtown Brooklyn, New York. Coming up next, It's a Good Day with Johanna Fernandez.
This is Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. You're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. Today on our program, we'll speak with Aaron Apple and Miss Steedy. These are two activists from the Free People's Strike. They are now on hunger strike to demand the release of vulnerable people from prison amid the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll also be joined by Sammy Felice. His brother, Alan, was murdered by the NYPD 8 months ago on October 17, 2019. We'll talk about the violent history of the NYPD, decarceration, and more. It's 7:02. Stay tuned for news and headlines.
Though I'm way overdue, I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if out my heart I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, cause I know yet. Not sing, cause I know yet. Then I'd sing, cause I know how it feels. I know how it feels to be free. Yeah, yeah, I know how it feels. Yes, I know how it feels.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert, says the next few weeks are critical to tamping down a disturbing coronavirus surge in the United States. He spoke before the House Energy and Commerce Committee on Tuesday and issued a plea for people to avoid crowds, to wear masks, and wash their hands. This was hours before mask-shunning Donald Trump was set to address a crowd of his young supporters at a coronavirus hotspot in Arizona. Despite controversy over Trump's comments that testing is finding too many infections, Fauci told the Congressional Committee that testing hasn't slowed and the country will be doing even more. Meanwhile, on Sunday, the World Health Organization reported the largest single-day increase in coronavirus cases. More than 183,000 new infections were registered in just 24 hours. And some countries which had successfully suppressed transmission of COVID-19 are now seeing an upswing as they reopen their economies. Across the U.S., coronavirus cases are rising in about half of the states, which are having uneven reopenings. In the states where cases are spiking the most, hospitalizations are also rising sharply. And infections continue to rise in U.S. prisons. In Texas alone, cases of COVID-19 have quadrupled over the past 3 weeks. Across the U.S., there has been a 73% jump in prison deaths since mid-May, and testing has been inadequately administered behind bars. New York hasn't even tested 3% of those inside. California tested less than 4%. This despite CDC recommendations to mass test large populations held in close quarters, even if they are asymptomatic. And yesterday, crowds mourned Rayshard Brooks at the AME Church in Atlanta, where Dr. King once preached. The pastor called Brooks a, quote, high-profile casualty in the struggle for justice, unquote. Brooks and officers struggled outside a restaurant on June 12th. A white officer shot him in the back after Brooks fired a taser in his direction while running away. King's daughter, the Reverend Bernice King, said Brooks' death, quote, will not be in vain because justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. In other news, the Confederate-themed Mississippi flag is drawing criticism from two big forces in that culturally conservative state. Walmart says it will no longer display the state flag because it includes the Confederate battle emblem. And the Mississippi Baptist Convention is calling on lawmakers to remove the Confederate symbol from the flag because they say many people are, quote, hurt and shamed by it. And a hanging noose was found in the garage stall assigned last week to the only black high-profile NASCAR driver, Bubba Wallace. This was only days after he pressured NASCAR to ban the Confederate flag from sporting events. The FBI launched an investigation and on Tuesday said the placement of the noose was not a hate crime, but had been in the stall since last year. Whatever the circumstances, the event comes as at least five black men were found hanging from trees in public places, including in Fort Tryon Park in New York City. Officials in all states maintain that the deaths were suicides, but family members and communities are skeptical. They say the deaths were lynching. It's 7:08 and you're tuned into listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. And it's 79 degrees this morning, and it will go up to 87. And it's mostly beautiful, as Michael G. Haskins said, although there will be some clouds this afternoon, this Wednesday, June 24th, 2020.
In the morning sun, I feel you touch me in the pouring rain, and the moment that you wander far from me, I wanna feel you in my arms again, and you come to me on a summer breeze, keep me warm in your love, then you softly leave, and it's me you need to show.
To you and me, I believe in you. You know the door to my very soul. You're the light in my deepest, darkest hour. You're my savior when I fall.
And that was the Bee Gees' How Deep Is Your Love, performed by the all-sibling group Infinity Song. Protesters in Pennsylvania have now been on a hunger strike for more than 3 weeks. The hunger strikers call their protest the Free People Strike, and it stands in solidarity with incarcerated people. The strike is supported by the Human Rights Coalition, Black Lives Matter Philly, Philly for Real Justice, the Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration, and many other organizations. The Free People Strike is continuing its rolling fast each day, with at least 10 people at a time hunger striking for 5 days or more, and more than 40 people participating in weekly one-day solidarity fasts. Their central demand calls on Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf to immediately release the 1,800 prisoners eligible for release under his April 10th reprieve order. In addition, it calls on the governor to release the 16,000 Pennsylvania prisoners who are over the age of 60 or have been deemed medically vulnerable by Department of Corrections Secretary John Wetzel. Let's take a listen to some of the strikers' words during their fast.
This is Siobhan, one of the hunger strikers with Free People Strike. It's day three. Not feeling too bad. Slowing down a bit. But I need y'all to pick up a bit. Come on over to our website. Like our page on Facebook, Free People Strike. Look at our demands. Fit in where you can fit in. Help us to move the hand of those who need to let our people go.
Today is my first day of a hunger strike, which through the Free People Strike to demand mass releases from Pennsylvania state prisons. There's currently over 45,000 people trapped in Pennsylvania state prisons. More of them are medically vulnerable than people on the outside for the same systemic reasons that led them to being incarcerated in the first place. If nothing changes, coronavirus outbreaks will mean thousands of deaths. That means thousands of people's lives ending in cages. The good news is it doesn't have to be this way. Governor Wolf of Pennsylvania has the power to release home anybody he wants using the constitutional power of reprieve. All governors have this right. The ACLU, Amistad Law Project, and the Abolitionist Law Center put together a list of demands indicating to Governor Wolf who should be sent home to keep everybody safe. Governor Wolf has continued to ignore that. So in April, he signed an order saying 1,800 people are eligible for reprieve, and he's released less than 160. The purpose of this hunger strike is to force Governor Wolf to take action. He will continue to ignore and minimize people on the inside. He'll continue to ignore and minimize the black and brown people who love them on the outside. White people are responsible for mass incarceration. We're responsible for police violence. The entire system was created to maintain white supremacy, to protect my body, my possessions.
Hi everyone, so today has been the first of my 3-day strike in solidarity with the Free People Strike. We demand that Governor Tom Wolf use his powers of reprieve to release the people incarcerated in so-called Pennsylvania, actually Lenni Lenape, Erie, Iroquois, Shawnee, Hanaisant, and Susquehannock land. Join me in calling Governor Tom Wolf to accelerate the release of the 1,800 people eligible under his April 10th release order, and to expand said order to include more people, beginning with those most at risk.
We're joined now by Aaron Appel and Ms. Didi, two members of the Free People Strike. Aaron Appel has been a member of the Human Rights Coalition since he moved to Philadelphia in July 2019 and has supported their campaigns against solitary confinement and to shut down SCI Fayette, a toxic prison. In May 2020, Mr. Appel joined the Free People Strike as a hunger striker and member of their striker onboarding team. Aaron came to the struggle through an Inside Out program at Riverside Correctional Facility in 2015 and through 6 years of community-based self-determination work in Detroit. And as the mother of an only child serving a life sentence, Lorraine Haw, better known as Ms. Didi, has been in this fight against incarceration for over 20 years. Initially, the fight was a solitary one with her and her family doing their best to support her son. Since joining the Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration at their first meeting, Ms. Didi has become a community-wide advocate for ending mass incarceration and freeing the vulnerable from prison. Ms. Didi identifies as a dual victim with her son incarcerated and her brother lost to gun violence, and she sees all too well how little our criminal justice system does to support her and others in her situation. Aaron and Ms. Didi, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to It's a Good Day.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you so very much for being on the hunger strike and for amplifying this very important crisis across the country in our prisons, especially in Pennsylvania. And you're pressuring Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf to commit to the urgency of decarceration in this moment. What exactly are your demands? Why don't we start with Aaron?
For sure. So you named a number of them at the beginning to release the 1,800 people eligible under the April 10 reprieve order and to expand that reprieve order because it's actually recommended that many, many, many more people than 1,800 be released. And so we have people incarcerated for drug trafficking offenses, technical violations of parole, medically vulnerable, who just simply can be released very easily. Additionally, we're asking to suspend the sentences for technical violations of parole so that we're not bringing more people inside. There's commutation applications awaiting Governor Wolf's signature. They are on his desk. He should sign those. In addition, we need to ensure that people who are released have proper reentry resources and supports, and that we're ensuring prevention, access to testing and medical care for those who remain incarcerated because so many people go in and out of prisons. It makes no sense to not support people inside in any way, even if you don't care about their their safety and well-being, which the governor doesn't seem to. And finally, to issue an emergency removal order on the Berks County Residential Center and release all families who are incarcerated there, because we can't limit this struggle just to the prisons. We need to talk about immigration and detention centers.
Right, and that's an area of incarceration that often gets left out of the conversation in this period. Yeah, there are plenty of people in detention centers, families, entire families. And you and others are asking for their release. Now, Ms. Didi, I'm wondering if you can try to tell us, I mean, this is boggles the mind, why Governor Wolf, but also other governors across the country, why have governors been so resistant to decarceration, especially in this moment of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, first of all, because they're more interested in other things being open, like the city being opened up, making money for the city. And then we had this person by the last name of Storm that's against it. And so it's the man that runs the DOC, which is Department of Correction, which is Wetzel. They're all in this thing. Okay, we're going to let go 1,800. Yeah, you haven't let go 160. And it's like they're constantly against it. Okay, I understand. Now, you know, we have two sides to this. We have the perpetrator side and we have the victim side. But right now we're having a pandemic where those that are vulnerable should be let go. And they're judging inmates by the crime that they did when they first did the crime at the beginning, when they should be judged by who they are today. Mm. And then they have a thing of saying, well, the violent versus the nonviolent. Well, everyone that did a crime is violent. But we can't go by what they've done centuries ago, decades ago. Let's go by who they are and what they've done while they were incarcerated. Let's judge them on that. Let's look at each individual differently instead of stocking everyone under one same category.
That's something we've heard from quite a number of people, especially the formerly incarcerated, that clearly the American carceral system is not about rehabilitation. It's only about punishment, because yeah, it doesn't matter what you do or how you remake yourself as a human being. The system is just not interested. And Pennsylvania, we know, is infamous for punishing young people. Pennsylvania is known for punishing young people and leaving them in prison for life. I think it's the last standing. It was, until very recently, the last standing state and prison system that had convicted teenagers, children, really, with these horrific sentences of life in prison without parole. You began with just a few people hunger striking indefinitely, but you've since transitioned to a rolling strike. Can you tell us more about that strategy? And also, why are you hunger striking?
Go ahead, Aaron. All right, I'll take a stab at it, then feel free to jump in. The hunger strike is a tactic that has been used for many, 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 many years on the inside as a way to fight for one's rights when so much else is denied. And hunger strikes have been used on the outside. It's an interesting moment for a hunger strike, certainly. And so we wanted to sort of be a part of that, that the history of that action and push that forward. And we also recognized, too, as we were launching the strike, that truly for Governor Wolf to be moved, we needed to have deep, deep relationships across the entire state of Pennsylvania. and many, many people coming together to push him. And so we realized that the rolling strike made sense while we were building power. And so we want to be adaptive to the situation on the ground, and we want to be like a learning effort. And so eventually it just became, it made strategic sense to switch to this sort of ongoing strike until we gather enough power for a, you know, escalation.
Mrs. Didi?
Yes, ma'am. The reason I got into it is because we want to be heard. That's the whole point of it. We want to be heard. We need them. When I say them, I mean everyone that's in the judicial system, but especially the governor who has that reprieve power of letting go inmates. And he claimed, you know, we're in this pandemic where for us out here, it's dangerous. So put your mindset in a prison where there is no such thing as social distancing. And if you see that there's inmates that are dying, they're getting this virus and they're dying, even the staff, why wouldn't you start letting them go? When we can take better care of them out here. And what is a 75-year-old man going to do out here? Again, I go back to the point of stop judging them for the crime they did decades ago. And let's look at them as what they are, human beings. They have a right to second chances just like any of us do. And why aren't they, you know, they're put in the back burner. He's more worried about liquor places being open, parks, recreation places, casinos. I mean, are you kidding me? But then again, it doesn't surprise me because they look at inmates as a dollar sign. That's their next yacht. That's their next summer house. That's their next income. That's their income coming in. And every inmate they let go, that's money flowing out of their pocket. So when they say that the judicial system is broken, no, it was never broken. It was built to be that way, to make money off the backs of the inmates.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Aaron Apple and Ms. Didi of the Free People Strike about COVID-19 in prisons and their fight to free their loved ones through this hunger strike. And you're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Streaming globally at WBAI.org. And we don't have much time, but I just want to reiterate something you've said, Ms. Didi, and remind our listening audience of our previous discussions, which is that incarceration is the largest employer, is the third largest employer in the United States, which is really shameful in a country that calls itself the land of the free, the third largest employer. And so part of what I've heard is that the unions of the prison guards have been lobbying and pressuring governors across the country to not decarcerate, to not let people go, because many prisoners, guard prisoners, or is that what they're called?
COs.
Correction
officers.
Yeah, correction officers. Sometimes with overtime, they make upwards of $100,000. So this is a huge power base that votes, and governors are listening to that base. But I want to end our conversation in the next minute. We just have a minute left with a question. You started your strike on May 28th, just as nationwide protests began, but also protests around the world. And now we have a sustained rebellion against white supremacy and police violence. How do you connect the call for decarceration to these rebellions that we're seeing against the police? Aaron, and then we'll end with Ms. Didi.
For sure. So prison abuse from guards happens regularly, just like police abuse in the streets. It's just hidden from view. Both are deeply interconnected on this continuum of oppression and violence. When we're talking about, you know, this moment out in the streets, it really must connect to the prison system. And, you know, when we're looking at city budgets and talking about, you know, the largest, you know, budget item being the police, you know, in Philadelphia, the third largest item is the prisons, right? And so we need to talk about, you know, defunding both and abolishing both. And we have the momentum to do so.
Ms. Didi?
And on that note, is people are tired. They're tired of losing their loved ones. They're tired of being used. They're tired of the mistreatment, the injustices. We don't reach a boiling point where, okay, this is where we have to start breaking down all these things that have been in place for hundreds of years, you know, making money off the backs of human beings. And let's start this from the ground up and rebuild it to where it's equality. And regardless of your race, your religion, your financial status, and treat people as they are, people.
Aaron, how can people... Go ahead. Finish your statement, Ms. Didi.
We're still in slavery time. Only thing, this is the new slavery, is imprisoning people and using them as money makers for them. So this is modern slavery.
Thank you for that insight. This is the moment of the new slavery in America. Aaron, how can people support this ongoing strike?
Definitely. So folks can get in touch with us through social media, Free People Strike. We have a website as well. Go to linktr.ee/FreePeopleStrike to see our demands and also to sort of access our various sign-up forms. So you can join us as a striker. You can join us on Wednesdays for a solidarity fast and post on social media. You can call Governor Wolf. You can reach out to your network, and you can find some way to help us amplify this message and influence the governor to let our people go.
And if you want to get more information, because you haven't been able to get all of this or write it down, you can email me at Johanna, J-O-H-A-N-N-A, at WBAI.org, Johanna@WBAI.org, and we will get you that information. Thank you both so very much for being with us and for the work you do.
Thank you so much.
This was great.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and you're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. We're going to take a short music break, and when we return, we'll speak with Sammy Feliz about police murder and the NYPD.
Still alive, and it's
That was another one down by 11-year-old Naima Nascimento. And when I heard that song, which was sent to me by Shandani Smith, one of our production assistants, I just started crying. This is an 11-year-old girl who's singing about the crisis of police terror across the country. She says, another one down, another one dead. But at some point she says, I wish it had been me instead. And this is the kind of world and trauma that children are being exposed to daily in this country. Over 1,000 people are killed by the police every year in the United States, without including those killed by cops in chokeholds. We don't know the names of the great majority of these people killed by the cops. We've learned the names of a number of Latinos killed recently: Eric Salgado, Sean Monterrosa, and Andres Guardado were recently killed in California. Another person ripped out of our hearts by killer cops is Alan Feliz, a native son of the Bronx. Alan was murdered by the NYPD 8 months ago on October 17th, 2019. And today we're joined by Alan's brother, Sammy Feliz, to discuss his brother and the long history of police terror and murder in the United States. Sammy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're very interested in hearing about the story, because a lot of New Yorkers don't know about it. And I'm going to ask you to speak a little louder into the phone.
Yeah, I can do that.
But, you know, as I've been listening to you speak in the last 2 weeks, because we've been at the same demonstrations, I've wondered about the emotional process you've undergone. So, for example, I'm wondering, what impact does hearing about another police killing have on you as the brother of Alan?
Honestly, when it comes to seeing what happened to my brother and seeing that still happening within the nation, whether that's here in New York or whether that's anywhere in the United States, it's troublesome. It's fearsome. It's a false sense of security, because these people are placed in our communities to protect and serve us. And what's happening is completely the opposite of that. Our lives are being taken, and there are unjust reasons for our lives to be taken. There isn't anything that warrants any of these killings, and that shows that there is a bigger problem within this policing system, and that change must be imminent on this system, so that way we can live our lives harmoniously within our communities.
So I know that this is probably difficult for you to retell, but can you tell us what happened on October 17th, 2019?
Yeah. So on October 17th, 2019, my brother Alan Feliz was leaving a friend's house. It was roughly 3 p.m. in the afternoon. He was leaving his friend's house to pick up his daughter, not one that he had birthed, but one that he had raised as his own. He left that house around that time. He hadn't been no more than a block, probably a block and a half from leaving his friend's house, when he crossed paths with a police cruiser. As they crossed going opposite ways, the officer claims in his story that he saw my brother was not wearing his seatbelt at the time and proceeded to do a U-turn and pull them over. When the officer approached the vehicle, he was able to see that the contrast of my brother's shirt, which was black, and the seatbelt being black, he claims that he did not see the seatbelt and that he was correctly wearing the seatbelt. He at that point apologizes to my brother, which is evidence that we can see on body cams that are available via YouTube. And once that interaction takes place where the seatbelt is on, in my understanding, the interaction should have stopped. He should have wished my brother a good day and proceeded with his routine. That at that point did not happen. The officer asked for license and registration and things of that nature. A warrant had appeared. My brother was asked to step out of the vehicle. When he is out of the vehicle, the officer reinstates and asks him to ensure that the vehicle is parked so that everything is secure. My brother walks to the vehicle, not runs, not flees, not takes off running for his life. He walks calmly to the vehicle and sits inside of it. I would assume, and I can't say that this is what happened because I can only see from the outside. I don't know what he was thinking, but I'm assuming that he's going to go check on this car like the officer had asked. When that happened, the officer that's standing on the driver's side starts an onslaught of punches, hitting my brother in the face, trying to drag him out of the vehicle. The officer on the passenger side of the vehicle then ensues to jump inside of the vehicle, get completely on top of the passenger of the vehicle, and starts to threaten my brother with lethal force. He pulls out his taser, discharges it twice, which they claim that was to no use. It didn't work. But in the video, you can hear my brother screaming for agony and pain with every single charge that's being dispersed through his body. This officer then ensues to hit my brother with the gun of the taser, threatened that he's going to effing kill him. I'm going to effing kill you within seconds of this interaction. And mind you, this whole interaction took less than 2 minutes. As he's continuing, they're both striking my brother at the same time. My brother's in a cocoon-like form, holding the steering wheel, trying to avoid his face from being destroyed from the onslaught of punches and melee that he's receiving to actually land and hurt him even further than he already is at this point. He's pleading for help from his passenger to see what he can do, but the passenger refuses to even get in the altercation because his life is at risk at this point, too, when he sees the way that the officers are acting. So he's unable to do anything. The officer on the passenger side then discharges one fatal shot to my brother's chest, which makes no sense. If you're trying to stop somebody, you would shoot to maim, not shoot to kill. So a shot in the chest, in my personal opinion, does not sit well, especially understanding of the location of where all this interaction is taking place, which was on 211th Street and Bainbridge in the Bronx, which is about a block and a half away from Montefiore Hospital. So if you wanted to maim the person, you can shoot them. They can recover in the hospital, and then they can go through their due diligence if the fear was that this person was going to escape. But the police, as we've seen within the last 50, 60 years or better, there has never been a shoot-to-maim mentality. There's always been a shoot-to-kill mentality. After they shot my brother, they then proceeded to drag him out of the vehicle, pantsless. This is at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when kids are coming out of school.
You mean they took his pants were off?
In the Bronx. His pants were pants and underwear completely off. And they have him taking the last breaths of air, face up, choking on his own blood, and then probably a good 40 seconds to 60 seconds after he's choked out on his own blood is when they decide to then still flip him over and put cuffs on him. So the image, and this is all being recorded by innocent bystanders that are walking, just filming the interaction in disbelief of what the police just did to a person in the community. It's something that's permanently engraved in my mind. That it's, as I tell you, I can second by second still see the video in my brain. It's engraved in my mother's brain. She wasn't able to sleep for months at a time. She still has trouble coping with the reality that my brother isn't here. He's left behind a 1-year-old son that well, just now turned one. He was about 5 months around the time of the incident or less. Left him behind fatherless, no one to take care of him or be there for him, teach him the ins and outs of life or how to be a man. It's just devastating. And then where we have people in positions like the commissioner, Monahan, the full name doesn't come to my mind, but this gentleman decided to go live at 5 o'clock when the incident happened at 3 o'clock, but he goes live at 5 p.m. and he's stating that, or pretty much justifying the officer's shooting, stating that this person had 10 types of substances in the vehicle, which they've never brought to the light, never showed any evidence of, and this is 8 months after the fact. We haven't seen no type of drugs that they've brought forward to, so we have no reason to believe anything they're saying on behalf of the drug front. And it's puzzling to me that this person can go on live, do the whole spill of what happened at the scene when the family has no idea that their loved one has been killed, when the family has no idea of what's happened. My mom actually saw the news on TV and had no idea that was my brother laying there lifeless in the Bronx. So that to us is disturbing that can happen. They identified who was there, who they had shot, and no phone call was made out. So they had from roughly 3 o'clock when the shot took place till midnight when they finally told us that my brother was no longer with us and that an investigation will be started on regards to what transpired that day. So that's a 9-hour window for the police department, everyone in charge, and anybody responsible for that case to do what they want to do without anyone being informed of what's happening.
To cook up the crime scene, essentially.
Yeah.
To cook up the crime scene.
Correct.
And you were referring to Chief Terrence Monahan.
Thank you so much. That is correct. Terrence Monahan is the gentleman who went live on that same day.
NYPD Chief of Police. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Sammy Feliz about police violence and the NYPD, but also the killing of his brother. You're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. And we don't have a lot of time, but we'd like to take at least one call. Please call us at 212-209-2877. Please call us at 212-209-2877. I'm Johanna Fernandez speaking to Sammy Feliz about the killing of his brother, Alan, by the NYPD. Can you tell us, Sammy, who was Alan to you?
That's a great question. Alan was, to me, I would say a better half of me, a better me, the best side of me, I would say. My complete, the yin to my yang. I really can't explain how valuable he was to me growing up. I grew up in a home with a single mother. My father was incarcerated my whole life. The only person I had to look up towards was my older brother. He made sure I kept my nose clean. He made sure that I knew what was right from wrong. He made sure I knew how to act and compose myself. He taught me everything that I know and I hold dear to me today. The value of that man is insignificant. The brightness that he brought to me and my entire family is missed. It's like we're in the darkest place ever because he was our sunlight. He ensured that no face would be
frowned upon or no one would be looked down upon within our family. He made sure everyone was taken care of. He made sure everyone was together and united. And still after his death, he's united me and my family even more. He's bridged and made stronger bonds within our family. And he continues to show us that together we are stronger, and together the love is able to be felt even stronger. I can go on about how special this man was to me and how much he did for me and how much I cherished and valued him and every single moment that there was. But now I'm set with the obstacle of using his methodology and his way of living and thinking to pass that down to his son, because his son will, everything that I got to enjoy growing up from that he brought to the table, his son won't get to enjoy. So I have to use those experiences and be able to shape and be able to raise his son the right way, how he would have intended him to be raised and how my brother raised me as we grew together, because he's only 2 years older than me, and he was still able to tuck me under his wing and treat me like a son and make sure that I did right. And I wouldn't be the man that I am today without him.
We have callers. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Stephen from Queens, New York. My condolences. Thank you for taking my call, and my condolences to you and your family.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask was, have you also dealt with, a civilian complaint review board or any councilman, any politicians, either, but someone who would help you and your family in finding some justice? Because I'll hang up, hopefully other people, but this thing happens every day and there are people who are killed and there are people who are not killed, but this has gone on for too long is all I'll say, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you so very much for calling.
Thank you. And yes, Stephen, we have gone through all the proper procedures into filing complaints against these officers. The way that things have been as of recent with the pandemic happening, it's definitely slowed things down to a crawl. So a lot of institutions were completely closed, and action or the time frame for these actions to take place has not been met because of the city being completely closed. We have reinitiated to engage in these conversations to make sure that the proper action is being taken. But these are things that we are still working on but have not been finalized. What we are trying to achieve now is gain as much awareness of my brother's case, because as we say that some of these names that have experienced these police brutalities or have been murdered by killer cops have been completely swept under the rug. There's so many names that are to this list. As you stated earlier, there's in excess of over 1,000 people that are killed yearly by the NYPD or by policing. And it's hard to keep up. It's hard to make sure that every voice is heard. And that's our current goal at the moment, is ensuring that at first Alan's name is heard, we're accounted for, we're being considered with all the other victims, and then going forward, ensuring that the due diligence is done when it comes to serving justice. And the first step to that is indicting these officers. And only that can be done through reaching the Attorney General, Letitia James. If we can raise awareness to Letitia James that we're looking for justice for Alan's murder, and that we won't take anything less than an indictment of these officers. And the most recent call to action that I've done for me and my community is on the @JusticeForAlan page on Instagram. They call to action for an email campaign reaching out directly to Letitia James and asking for justice for my brother's murder. Now, we've so far have in excess of probably 5,000, close to 6,000 emails that have reached to her from Father's Day. So we're expecting a huge impact, and we expect the community to support us in this action 100%.
We have another call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes. Good morning, Johanna, and good morning, Mr. Felice. This is Fidel from Jersey City. I want to say that I'm really sorry about what happened to you. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And as we've been discussing, it happens all too often, these being the most egregious of the cases, but they happen in lower cases as well, and they disrupt families all across this country. We cannot continue to rely on the system. The system is broken. We have to figure out how to break it down and rebuild it, because when we get these politicians who are already pretty much in bed with their donors, then they come in and they reshape their mentality. So it is them joining with us, and there's never any evidence of when they join with us, we move the needle to the left where we should be going. We end up moving our left needle more towards the center to appease them. Once again, it's capitalism at its core. And what happened in Pennsylvania, there were judges that were jailed because they took kickbacks from the prison industrial complex. And it was so egregious that those two or three of them ended up going to jail because of what they were doing to children, putting them in prison in perpetuity. This system is completely working for the ones that manipulate everything. And when we talk about our cities, they don't belong to us. They take money from us, but the services never come back to us. They spend money on lawsuits that are brought against the city and the cops, like I'm doing in Jersey City, because I had a cop falsely arrest me, and then he sits on the stand and lies. And I've got all the evidence. I've worked within the system. I've sent to the Attorney General. I've sent packages all over. Nothing gets done because the system won't budge. I feel very sorry for what happened to you. I'm going to go online. I'm going to sign that email, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so very much, Fidel. And you're talking about the Kids for Cash scandal in Lucerne County in Pennsylvania, where judges were getting kickbacks for literally sending kids to jail. Alan, we have like 30 seconds left. Can you tell us once again, how can people help you amplify the name of your brother? Because that is the only way. We need to know, New Yorkers need to know who Alan Felice was and how he got murdered by the cops. How can we help?
Yes, most definitely. So there's a few outlets that we use. We do use Instagram, which is our main page, and that is at Justice for Alan, A-L-L-A-N. That's where we're putting all of our rallies, marches, protests, anything that we have, up and coming events will be listed on there. Any call of action is listed is there as well. We do have a Twitter handle as well with the same name, at Justice for Alan, and that's where we share kind of follow up with the Instagram page. And when it comes to what is needed in regards to getting his name out there, any follow, share, repost, word of mouth within communities, all we have to do is speak to each other, and the news quickly spreads. Why should news be hesitant to spread when it comes to these situations, when it affects our communities directly? So I think getting the word out within your community is the most important thing, because these are the people who are supposed to be here to protect us.
This show is produced by Jorgen Ostensen, Ajamo Sankofa, Shandani Smith, and Ellis Maxwell. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in. It's a good day. Sammy, our heart is with you, our condolences, and we will keep up the fight.
Thank you so much,
Johanna. Like, who on top of this? People with sussling, arguing and bustling. Gangsters of Gotham, hardcore hustling. I'm wrestling with words and ideas. My ears prick, thinking what will transmit, the scribes can apply.
WB